History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's program, votes, violence and victory are the major political players competed for support a century ago against the backdrop of revolution. Also, the intelligence war against the IRA. We'll hear about a new book that evaluates to what extent the British infiltrated the IRA during the Troubles and what role British intelligence played in finally producing peace. Plus, the story of Hitler's Irishmen, two soldiers who swore an oath of allegiance to the Waffen-SS. But to begin this evening, a century ago, Ireland was going through an accelerated political evolution. And one of the best ways to analyse the changes during these revolutionary years is by looking at what was going on, not just at the polling stations, but in the thick of hard-fought election campaigns. A new book called Electioneering and Propaganda in Ireland, 1917 to 1921, Votes, Violence and Victory, analyses the political rivalry between all the major parties during Ireland's revolutionary years. The author is Dr. Elaine Callanan. Elaine, you're very welcome back to the History Show.
Thank you very much.
Now, the period covered in the book is one of obviously great political upheaval. There are by-elections, local elections, and probably the most significant, the general election of 1918. It was a very different political scene than the one we're used to now. And in the book, you outline the four main political interests who were competing, who were participating. The Nationalists of Sinn Féin, the Home Rule Nationalists of the Irish Parliamentary Party, the Unionists and Labour, although obviously not Labour in 1918. Generally speaking, what would a campaign look like in those days? How different would it have been from today's campaigns?
Well, it was much more lively than today's campaigns, but it differed in a couple of different reasons. First of all, you could campaign right up until the person was walking into the polling booth. So, you know, you'd bunting and you'd banners and you'd leaflets and you'd people at the polling stations handing out those leaflets. So it was very lively. But in its liveliness as well, it could also be intimidating because, for example, if you were nationalist living in a unionist area and your polling station was bedecked in red, white and blue, you might be intimidated to go in and cast your vote. And similarly for unionist and nationalist dominated areas, that kind of intimidation might have put off people going to the polling station and casting their votes. But it was much more lively. And of course, you know, they relied heavily on things like posters and newspapers to get messages across. So the country was bedecked with poster campaigns and the posters were much more lively than they are today.
They were quite creative, but also, as I recall, the ones that I've seen, they contained a lot of information.
They did. Well, just in regard to creativity, I mean, they did lean on image a lot to get across messages. And of course, the one we're most familiar with in the 1918 general election is the Put Him In to Get Him Out, which depicts a man dressed in a prison uniform with the words Put Him In to Get Him Out and then maybe Vote De Valera or something. But I mean, to the people of the day, that was easily transcribed. It was really meant Put Him In Politics to Get Him Out of Jail. That kind of image was used quite regularly, and unlike today's elections where you see smiling faces and vote so-and-so in Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael or Sinn Féin or whatever it happens to be. I mean, all the political posters today look the very same. Back then they were competing, they were using different imagery, they were drawing on history, they were drawing on myths, they were drawing on, you know, colour in terms of flags and bunting. They were also you know, using a lot of words in some instances. But then bear in mind that people back then were standing in railway stations and bus stations waiting for periods of time. So they could actually pause and read material. Today we live in a much faster paced world.
Now, I suppose one of the other huge differences is that most of the elections during this period would have been conducted using a system very different to the one that we're familiar with in Irish elections today.
You're absolutely right, particularly the 1917 and 18 by-elections and the 1918 general election. They used the first-past-the-post system of voting, and that was literally where you went in and put an X by the candidate's name that you wanted to elect. Now, that changed in 1920 with the introduction of proportional representation. And of course, with the introduction of proportional representation, now you listed candidates in order of preference. And this means really that, you know, the emphasis on the candidate became, more real in terms of the voting public. So you had to show who the candidate was and tell a little bit more about them. So you even see a change in 1920 and in 1921 elections, where you see the use of candidates' names, their occupations, maybe even their address on some of the posters, where the political message is much reduced. And of course, that has evolved into today's style of showing the face, because now the face is on the ballot paper, plus the name and the political affiliation. So the difference in the voting system has affected the type of poster or propaganda method that has been used.
I suppose one of the major differences also would have been, for many of these elections, women would not have been able to vote. And then when they were able to vote, women under the age of 30 were not able to vote.
Yes, that's absolutely true. The 1918 Representation of the People Act brought in the capacity for women over the age of 30 to vote in the by-elections and the general elections. Now, they could, since 1898, vote in the local elections. But now, with the 1918 Act, they could not only vote, but they could also run as candidates in these elections. The impact was fairly strong in terms of, if you read the newspapers of the time, you certainly see a large turnout of women, a reporting on a large turnout of women at these elections. It is interesting that they picked the over 30, but the rationale or the reason for that, if you read through the House of Commons debates particularly, is that they did fear that if they gave women over 21 the vote, like men, that there'd be far too many women and women would take over the voting in the elections.
Now, you yourself, before studying history, I know, had a misspent youth in the field of public relations. And so you have a huge interest in marketing and advertising. Talk to us a bit about the modernisation of campaigning in this period in terms of adopting new advertising practices.
Yes, and it is very interesting that all of this happens at this time as well. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I spent a good few years working in advertising and public relations, primarily with Wilson Hartnell. But consumerism had hugely grown in this area, really from the late 1800s. You see the advent of the big department stores, and even in Dublin with the likes of Arnott's and Cleary's and department stores like that. And of course, they were beginning to advertise out to the general public to generate consumerism. And the other big change as well that was happening in this time was newspapers were also using image in their advertisements. Now, political parties didn't use the image in newspapers, but they certainly used the different font sizes that were now available. And, you know, the good political parties were aware of this growing consumerism and this idea of appealing to the public and using a call to action to get people to do something. For consumers, it was to buy a product, but for politics, it was to cast a vote in a particular way. So all of this influence was coming in to Ireland from places like the United States, but it was awakening in the political interest in Ireland as well. And we see this particularly in Sinn Féin at the time, because they produce an article in one of their publications, Larna Héireann, that actually encourages candidates, political candidates, to look to advertising methods in America, adopt them and apply them to suit Irish interests. So there's a growing awareness. And of course, now we're also seeing the likes of advertising agencies being established in Ireland. McConnell's opened in 1916 and Wilson Hartnell himself was around since 1879. So this idea of marketing, advertising, capturing the audience and then making them do something was a big phenomenon.
And what influence did the mass media propaganda of the Great War have on election advertising during this period? Because obviously in the case of the Great War, there was an attempt to sell a product there as well.
Yeah, this is where, if you like, the targeted advertising or public relations, as we call it today, propaganda, as they called it then, really moved from just aiming at particular consumers to aiming it at a mass audience. This was a moment in time where really whole nations had to be mobilised to support a cause, regardless of what side it was on. So what this really encouraged was kind of mass poster advertising, mass use of print media like newspapers. And then, of course, you know, in later years of the Great War, when they had film, they began to use film as well. Now, film wasn't used in political propaganda because it was silent back in the time. But certainly you see a very large increased use of posters, handbills, pamphlets, you also see, you know, quite extensive use of editorial in newspapers and advertising in newspapers. And all of this is borrowed from that kind of mass media of the Great War.
Now, we talked about those four large factions who were involved in the elections during this period in Ireland. How many of them specifically went out to try and get the female vote in that 1918 general election? Obviously, Labour, no, because they weren't involved, although they were involved in local elections. But certainly the other three parties who did compete in that 1918 general election.
Well, I have to give it to Unionists and Sinn Féin in that regard. They were particularly active in targeting women. Now, they targeted women in two ways, primarily. One was to actually encourage women to go out on polling day and cast their vote in favour of a particular party. But the other was to try and mobilise women to become actively involved in politics. Now, not as candidates, but as agents going out door to door canvassing, distributing leaflets. So unionists were very clever at doing that, so much so that they also encouraged women to hold meetings directed primarily at women and to have women speakers at those meetings where possible. Sinn Féin directed targeted propaganda to women and drew on kind of images like, you know, Dark Rosaline, Mother Erin, to kind of show women that they were part of this new Ireland going forward, this Gaelic Ireland going forward. Weak was the Irish Parliamentary Party. Now, they had already kind of set their stall back in the early Home Rule days when they had voiced kind of opposition to giving women the vote. And I think John Dillon, and I'll have to paraphrase here, but he referred to the fact that giving the women the vote was going to ruin Western civilization. Women remembered this in 1918. So, you know, there wasn't that much targeted voting by the Irish Parliamentary Party, except for Joe Devlin in Belfast. He was good at it. He addressed Irish men and Irish women, or ladies and gentlemen, in his advertisements to get votes there.
Now, political rallies were obviously an important way in those days for candidates to reach out to potential voters. And we've all seen the silent footage of Collins and De Valera giving speeches. They seem to be shouting at the top of their lungs. Obviously, they had no amplification in those days. How popular, how attractive were rallies to voters, back in the lead up, say, to the 1918 general election?
They were hugely popular. I mean, bear in mind that there was very little other entertainments to attract your attention. I mean, there was no television, there was no radio. So, you know, a popular politician or even the local politician coming to town to give a speech was a really important event, because local candidates even had other popular figures on the platforms with them. So people went out of their houses to participate in these big political rallies. Now, you're right that there was no amplification. So if there was a very, very large crowd at a political speech, the chances were, if you were midway or down the back, you weren't actually able to hear the speaker. But that was neither here nor there. You went for the atmosphere and the ambience of the event. And some also went for more subversive reasons. They might have gone to cause trouble. So, like, for example, if you were a Hibernian and you were attending a Sinn Féin rally, you weren't there to support Sinn Féin. You were there to disrupt the speech. And then others went along because they knew there was going to be disruption or violence at it. And that even in itself was entertainment. But the politicians, even though you're right, they were shouting, and, you know, people at the front perhaps could hear what they were saying. But what then became very important to those politicians was to get those speeches published in the local newspaper the next day so that people could read what was actually said at the speeches.
Now, when you read Bureau of Military History witness statements from this period, many of those who are giving these statements would have been involved in election campaigns, in by-election campaigns during this period. And there are lots of references to something that you were talking about there, to violence, one of the three V words in the title of your book. How serious was the violence? I know you're saying that, you know, some people went along for the entertainment of the violence, but it could go well beyond entertainment on occasions, couldn't it?
It absolutely could. Now, largely speaking, in the quieter counties, there was little or no violence, but there were certain counties where, you know, the violence was quite intense. Places like Waterford, for example, was very controversial during the by-elections and the general election. Then you also had John Dillon's hometown in County Mayo, Ballyhardine. That was also particularly violent. And areas of Ulster were particularly violent during those elections, particularly in Belfast. And in some of those, you had volunteers and Hibernians arriving on the scene of political meetings, bearing hurling sticks or revolvers with every intent of using them. You know, confrontation was sparked in order to instigate violence. Sometimes, however, that violence tapered off at the end of the day and the competition was less violent and then reduced down more into ballad sing-offs on certain occasions between Hibernians and volunteers. But really, it depended on how controversial the candidates were in various different areas. And of course, Waterford was a Redmondite constituency. You know, there was very vested interest by the likes of the Ballybricken pig farmers in making sure that the Irish Parliamentary Party were elected in the city. And they wanted to get rid of the volunteers and Sinn Féin out of that area. So they were hell-tent on violence there.
We tend to assume that all the campaigns during this period were based on unionist versus nationalist, and within nationalism, the two, the constitutional nationalists and the militant nationalists. So that, you know, we think in terms of macro politics and ideology and all of this. To what extent did the more mundane things like tax, pensions, housing, all of that, those issues come into play in these elections?
Well, they came into play very significantly. I mean, even if we take the big 1918 general election, I mean, it starts off with the high ideologies of home rule, union, separatism. But it very soon changes over as we approach election date because a realisation dawns on the political parties that people are far more interested in who's going to pay the old age pension. What's the taxation system going to be like? And there was kind of even a war of, you know, taxation ideas with unionists, you know, accusing the likes of Sinn Féin that if they come to power, everybody will be taxed to the hilt because they have no money to run the country. And then you have Sinn Féin accusing unionists and, you know, the British Empire of taking all the Irish taxpayers' money. And if they come to power, they'd be able to reduce everything because we won't be paying for an empire. So taxation becomes a very big feature as election day looms. And of course, as well as that, farming also becomes a very big feature in terms of land ownership, and which is the old agrarian conflicts kind of raise their heads a little bit as well. But really, it does boil down for the ordinary person into some of those key issues in much the same way as it does today.
Was there anything in those days even vaguely resembling opinion polling?
No, not so much opinion polling as we'd understand it today. But what you would see is newspapers kind of hazarding a guess at how their, particularly provincial newspapers, hazarding a guess at how the constituency might vote. Now, in the contested constituencies, there were 25 uncontested constituencies. But, you know, they might say that there's a strong Sinn Féin contingent here, or, you know, this is an Irish Parliamentary Party constituency, they'll walk this election. Now, they weren't always right in terms of their predictions, but that was the closest you'd really get to an opinion poll.
Now, finally, obviously, the war was over by December 1918, so conscription was off the agenda. But did it cast a pall? Was there the ghost of conscription? Was that element present in the campaigning in December 1918?
Yes, it was very much so. And of course, it was the blame game then at that stage. I mean, the Irish Parliamentary Party were blaming Sinn Féin, Sinn Féin's very existence for causing partition, and Sinn Féin were counteracting that as well. And then equally, both sides were claiming success. In other words, the Irish Parliamentary Party were saying it was because they had had voice in the House of Commons and they were able to speak on behalf of Irish people that conscription had been avoided, even though, bear in mind, they did walk out of the House of Commons in 1918 when the Military Service Bill was extended to Ireland. Sinn Féin, on the other hand, maintained that it was their policies and their arguments that actually stopped conscription in Ireland as well. So that's really how it played out. And of course, partition and the whole idea of conscription is taken a little bit into the 1921 general election. which would be 100 years ago in June of 2021, because partition is based on all of these kind of divides as well between the unionist nationalist and between even Sinn Féin and the Irish Parliamentary Party within nationalism.
Well, Elaine, it's an absolutely fascinating topic. Obviously, we've just scratched the surface of what you have covered in the book. The book is called Electioneering and Propaganda in Ireland, 1917 to 1921, Votes, Violence and Victory. And it's published by Four Courts Press. The author is Dr. Elaine Callanan. Elaine, many thanks indeed for joining us on the History Show this evening.
Thank you very much indeed.
After the break, we'll hear about the intelligence war against the IRA during the Troubles. Stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. It's been 22 years since the Good Friday Agreement formally brought an end to the Troubles. My next guest has studied that three-decade conflict through the prism of British intelligence activities against the IRA. I'm joined by Dr. Thomas Leahy, Senior Lecturer in British and Irish Politics at Cardiff University and author of the book The Intelligence War Against the IRA, which evaluates what role British intelligence played in finally producing peace. Thomas, you're very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Many thanks.
When the Troubles began in the late 1960s, did the British have much of an information or intelligence gathering capacity in place, or did they have to build a network from scratch?
So, yes, the intelligence capacity and the opportunity to try and build that capacity began straight away. But because the Provisional IRA, as it was known, was a new organisation with a lot of young members with no family background in republicanism, it did take time to build intelligence, you know, in terms of who were the key players. And I think evidence suggests there was a lack of information at the start of the campaign on the IRA. For instance, we can see this with internment without trial in August 1971. You know, a lot of people were arrested from the nationalist community initially who were not associated with republicanism at all. And actually, various key IRA members were not arrested initially either. It was hard to build that intelligence initially when, for instance, the Bogside area of Derry City was barricaded and known as Free Derry. So therefore, you know, gathering intelligence in these areas was very difficult and allowed the IRA to operate with some relative freedom in cities initially. Perhaps the key reason, though, is that the Provisional IRA, as mentioned, was a new organisation. So a lot of members joined because of anger about the civil rights movement's treatment, the Royal Ulster Constabulary and the British Army actions in localities and for other reasons. So therefore, there was not already intelligence on some of the key figures that emerged.
Now, I presume capacity was built, an apparatus of some kind was built using agents and informers. So just if you would tell me, what is the difference between an agent and an informer?
So essentially, there's three distinct categories of the types of people passing intelligence on the IRA. So first, there's informers, and informers were IRA members who provided information to Royal Ulster Constabulary Special Branch or various branches of British intelligence that operated in Northern Ireland. Second, there's agents, and agents were not previous members of paramilitary groups like the IRA, but they would, for various reasons though, agree to infiltrate the IRA in order to pass information to the intelligence services. And then you have this third category, which we can term as British Army agents. So this type of agent is a member of the British Armed Forces who infiltrates the IRA for the intelligence services. Now, when this occurred, it tended to be persons from Northern Ireland in the British Army for the obvious reason that someone from England, Scotland, or say Wales, suddenly wishing to join the IRA with a British Army background was going to look pretty suspicious to the IRA in the first place. So yeah, there was a distinction between informers and agents during the conflict.
Why did people become informers, or even why did people become from Northern Ireland itself, infiltrate themselves into the IRA and become agents?
So there's a variety of reasons why one person would inform. And what's interesting is these motives for informing could change even for a single person over time as well. So one useful summary of motives is actually given in some work by Stan A. Taylor and Daniel Snow in a term they used called MICE. And that relates to common motives they discovered for why some Americans informed for the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And what this MICE acronym stands for is money, ideology, compromise or coercion, and ego. And they've added to that excitement and revenge as two other factors. Now, we find similar factors help to account for why some people informed on the IRA. So let's take the case of Raymond Gilmore, a former IUC special branch agent who informed on the IRA in the early 1980s. Now, in Raymond Gilmore's memoirs and those of one of his former handlers, they say that Gilmore initially informed partly to avoid a prison sentence for low-level criminality. But they also claim anger for Gilmore of what he saw as IRA social control measures. Also, he had, he says, a desire to save lives and also financial reasons motivating him as well. So the motivations for informing are many and they could alter over time for a person as well. The trouble is we cannot get inside someone's head here and verify these motives. So it's difficult then to say that there's a dominant motive or factor in most cases.
Now, I think the IRA at the beginning of the Troubles were still organised in the kind of structures that had obtained in the 1920s. I mean, during the War of Independence, brigades, battalions, companies, all this sort of grandiose military terminology. That changes, though, in the 1970s, and they revert far more to even further back in the mists of Irish history, and that's the cell structure of the Fenian Brotherhood or the Irish Republican Brotherhood. Tell me how that worked and how that impinged on the work of British intelligence.
Sure. So by 1975, the IRA introduced a smaller organisation in Belfast and Derry cities, as the leadership's new aim was persistence, not escalation by that point, and also to prevent informers setting up mass arrests. So in 1977, the IRA publicly announces it would fight what it called a long war, which was until British forces grew weary and decided to withdraw. But it's interesting with this because growing evidence suggests the IRA leadership saw the long war in another way. And the evidence for this comes from senior Republicans, journalists, the late Father Alec Reed and others. So certainly by the 1980s, the long war seemed to actually be about forcing the British government to return to negotiations. And the failed 1972 and 1975 ceasefire talks between the IRA and British state had seemed to convince Republican leaders, at least, the British would not suddenly withdraw. So instead, IRA leaders felt persistent IRA activity, and by the 1980s, a sizeable Sinn Féin electoral mandate could pressurise the British government and other parties to return to talks. So IRA leaders would seek as much concessions as possible in talks. Now, this focus on persistence partly explains the new cell structure in Belfast and Derry cities from 1975. So the Belfast IRA, as an example, before this point used to operate on a brigade, battalion and company structure, similar to previous versions of the IRA in Irish history. Now, various people on the same street, for example, in Belfast, would therefore be in the same IRA unit. But what that meant was one informer could just set up mass arrests. And this was experienced by the Belfast IRA in 1973, for example. So the cells meant that the Belfast and Derry City IRA reduced its numbers. They would consist typically of 4 to 6 volunteers, and they would mix volunteers from across different parts of the cities to try and confuse British intelligence. And these small cells meant if someone informed, the damage, in theory, would be restricted to one cell, one unit. Now, the important caveat here is the small, tight-knit nature of rural Republican areas and Republican communities, such as in South Armagh, meant that the cell structure was never introduced there because it wasn't needed.
Now, the contention of your book, I think, is that despite the revelations of many IRA informers, political factors actually played a greater role in producing peace than any kind of victory, perhaps, in the intelligence war by the British.
That's right. So, and I think the key thing here is there certainly were British intelligence successes against the IRA in specific time periods in certain regions. But there were certainly intelligence gaps too. Current evidence seems to suggest that British intelligence did not force the IRA into peace to any significant extent. And there's 3 reasons I give for this argument. So first, the Belfast and Derry City IRA cell structure did enable the IRA to persist. So despite agents such as State Knife and other informers that have come to light, the Belfast IRA still carried out various high-profile city centre bombings in the 1990s, in the early 90s in particular. So the Belfast IRA maintained a heightened security environment there by the 1994 ceasefire. The second reason is that the elusive and tight-knit nature of rural IRA units enabled the rural IRA to persist. So yes, the East Tyrone IRA certainly faced setbacks at the hands of the SAS from the late 1980s into the early 1990s. but the South Armagh IRA, the North and Mid Armagh IRA, IRA units in Fermanagh, they did persist to varying degrees by the 1994 ceasefire of the IRA for various reasons. So British forces and Republican sources interestingly agree that rural IRA units were no sideshow, and they actually enabled the IRA to persist and spread its campaign. And the third reason is that the IRA's very highest levels, so its army council, the seven people, did not appear to be significantly infiltrated. And they would have selected volunteers for operations in England and to bring in weapons shipments, as an example. So this is one way we can test this argument. And there were successes at times against them. So the largest weapons shipments from Libya was captured in 1987, for example. But other large Libyan weapons shipments got through, and that enabled the IRA to persist. And in England, the IRA carried out various high-profile attacks, and that includes the Brighton bombing of the Conservative Party conference in 1984 and various attacks that we all know about in London in the 1990s. And the IRA's Army Council had a long-term leadership of committed Republicans, and that made them difficult to infiltrate. So on a day-to-day level, yes, British intelligence had some successes against specific IRA units in specific time periods, but the evidence suggests that they were not forced into peace by intelligence.
Now, this is a murky world we're talking about here. It's a world of bluff and double bluff. It's a world of deception. Did British intelligence, is there any evidence to suggest that British intelligence ever managed to con the IRA into executing somebody as an informer who was actually not an informer, who was a, if you can, I can use the phrase, a legitimate member of the Irish Republican Army?
Sure. So there's certainly examples and evidence where there's suspicions this might be the case. Always the caveat with this, which makes it difficult to discern this, is that British intelligence has a policy of neither confirming nor denying whether an alleged person was an agent and informer, which from their perspective partly makes sense because they have to protect people who were informers and agents, haven't been revealed. And also you could see that, you know, future agents and informers in today's world are going to be put off if identities are suddenly revealed 10, 20 years down the line. So it's always difficult to know. But, you know, there certainly seems to have been cases which we can partly see because the IRA on a few occasions has apologised for killing suspected people as agents or informers and then said, you know, in hindsight, they've looked back and said that's not the case. So this seems to have been the case. In terms of that being at senior levels, from what we know, doesn't necessarily seem to have actually been the case. But yeah, sure, there were certainly examples from what we know where that occasionally was happening to people.
And were many operations allowed to go ahead, IRA operations allowed to go ahead by British intelligence, because to have prevented these operations from continuing would have jeopardised a spy within the ranks, an agent or an informer?
I think this is a really interesting question. I think from the existing evidence that it's possible, certainly, that smaller level attacks might have gone ahead. So what I mean by that is potentially maybe some IRA public displays, such as checkpoints, manning, that they may have allowed that to happen. They may have allowed, you know, maybe some low-level robberies by the IRA for the movement. But in terms of major events, so for example here, if we look at the debates about whether the senior ranks of the IRA were permanently infiltrated, such as the IRA leadership, there doesn't seem to be the categorical evidence to suggest that's the case. And if we look at, yes, there are some attacks, for example, in high-profile attacks in England, which has stopped. So we know, as one example, that Sean O'Callaghan, so a self-confessed Gardaí and British intelligence informer against the IRA, was stopping some operations in England in the early 1980s. But when we, you know, as two standout examples, the 1984 Brighton bombing, which nearly killed Margaret Thatcher and did kill others, and the 1991 attack on Downing Street by the IRA, you know, these are things that senior informers or agents would have had to stop and British intelligence that they could have done so. And that's alongside the catalogue of attacks in London and also Manchester as standout examples in the 1990s that led to major economic costs, but also loss of life as well. So I think, yes, possibly at a lower level, it's possible that some IRA disruptions to local areas might have been allowed. But certainly in terms of the major standout attacks, that would have made no sense to the intelligence services at all, because it was actually allowing the IRA's campaign to persist and gain more publicity.
probably the most high-profile spy, British spy, British intelligence agent in the IRA, was known by the codename Steak Knife. Mm-hmm. Was he a kind of a Kim Philby? What impact did he have on IRA operations?
So I think with the Steak Knife case, we certainly seem to know that some kind of agent Steak Knife existed, because various Republicans, be they pro-peace process Republicans or dissenting Republicans, would accept this. And that's the case also with various British security and intelligence officials as well. The identity is disputed, and the person obviously who's been accused of this and denies all allegations. But it seems from the evidence we can piece together that this person operated in what's called the IRA's internal security units, certainly from the late 70s, but definitely into the 1980s period. The debate, again, is about the remit of this unit. So from the evidence I could piece together, it seems certainly they had an impact on the IRA in Belfast in specific periods, particularly the kind of mid to late 80s period, where they'd be able to vet certain cells and volunteers as part of a vetting process for the organisation, and also to root out informers. What seems, if we even just look at Belfast as one example, so yes, they seem to have some impact. Certainly there's various security forces in their memoirs or in interviews, or also Republicans who suggest that, you know, maybe up to 8 out of 10 IRA operations in Belfast by the 1990s are being prevented. But at the same time, you know, there's these high profile city centre bombings in Belfast again between 91 and 93. And in terms of injuries, loss of life, but also substantial economic damage, you know, the evidence suggests there's no way British intelligence would just allow those things to happen if they could stop them. So what that suggests, even related to Belfast, is the agent Steak Knife seems to have some access there to some IRA units, but not complete access in the team's gaps, perhaps because of things such as cell structure. If we then look elsewhere, particularly with the IRA's rural campaign, take the example of South Armagh, where the IRA is carrying out sniper attacks in the 1990s still. It's also able to carry out various attacks on security force bases and security forces themselves. And there's been allegations they were supporting IRA operations elsewhere, including high-profile attacks in England in the 1990s. With all of those things going on, that also, you know, strongly suggests that the IRA, in terms of Steak Knife, was not able to just access and infiltrate other units. And partly that makes sense because various British intelligence, security, some former agents and informers themselves have even said, you know, it was not the case where someone from Belfast could just walk into South Armagh and ask to vet their volunteers. That just wouldn't happen, because partly for security reasons, but also it didn't make any sense because the South Armagh IRA would know their volunteers better and would be able to vet them in a more thorough way than some outsider would have done. So with Steak Knife, some impact in Belfast it seems to be, but, you know, in other units that doesn't really seem to be the case.
Using information provided by agents and informers, to what extent were the British security forces capable of capturing arms shipments to the IRA during the Troubles?
Yes, so we can certainly see that there were some arms shipments that were captured. But at the same time, the ones they didn't capture would be significant here too. And that includes the Libyan weapons, for example, in the 1980s that landed before the Exxon was seized, which was the big one in 1987. So in the 1980s, we know that Sean O'Callaghan, for example, a self-confessed informer, helped prevent a shipment from the United States coming in to the IRA. We also know that the Exxon in 1987 was captured off the French coast. What we don't know with the Exxon is whether that was seized by luck, as some interviewees suggested, or informers. Although an interesting point here is one British official has suggested they didn't often get definitive information about large IRA shipments of weapons, but they did with the Exxon. So there seems to be some hint towards that there. But the key point here is that the other Libyan weapons shipments in the 1980s were not apprehended. And this matters because, as Sean O'Callaghan and members of the British intelligence reflected themselves, the IRA, with its low-intensity campaign, now had more weapons by the late 1980s than it could actually use. So it had the weapons to persist indefinitely. So the security forces did intercept a few shipments, but the ones that got through allowed the IRA to persist.
Finally, the IRA did suffer some serious losses in the 1980s, personnel blows, psychological blows. I'm thinking particularly of Loch Gull and Gibraltar. What part did informers or agents play in the failure of those IRA operations, if any?
It's difficult to say definitively here. I mean, there certainly is some suggestions that there were informers or intelligence sources of some sort at work here. But I think a key thing is the SAS, which was involved in both incidents, Gibraltar and Loch Gall, the SAS rarely just happens to appear by chance against its adversaries. So it's in place often based on reasonably good intelligence. So in relation to Loch Gall or Gibraltar, available evidence seems to suggest the British had intelligence beforehand. So we can just even deduce this by the fact that, take Loch Gall, for example, the SAS seemed to know exactly which police station the IRA would hit. But that does not necessarily mean it was an informer. So by the late 1980s, there's the evolution of listening devices, for example. So it's not out of the question that intelligence could have been gathered from that kind of source as well. But there's a few other factors to consider here as well with these incidents. So various interviewees and memoirs pointed out that many Republicans killed in Gibraltar or at Loch Gall were seasoned Republicans. So some had served prison sentences and or were involved in Sinn Féin. So these individuals were known as such to intelligence services already. For major operations, be it in England or Gibraltar, for example, the tricky thing for the IRA was that they needed expertise. But with expertise comes the problem that the people involved would often be known. So it was a risk by employing people with expertise. But in addition, some Republicans did feel that in the Loch Gall case, for example, prior intelligence beforehand by the IRA should have been stronger to ensure that they'd get away with it. But as we say, it's difficult to know exactly what was happening here. But the key point is informers cannot always explain why there were some successes against the IRA.
Well, thank you very much for casting some light on some of the dark corners of the troubles of that particular conflict. The book is called The Intelligence War Against the IRA. It's published by Cambridge University Press. The author is Dr. Thomas Leahy. Thomas, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the History Show this evening.
Many thanks for having me. Thank you.
After the break, Hitler's Irishman, the story of the young men from Ireland who joined the Waffen-SS.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. Finally tonight, we bring you the tale of two young Irishmen who joined the armed forces of Nazi Germany. Mark McMenamin has the story.
During the Second World War, the Waffen-SS were one of the most feared organisations in Nazi Germany. Its formations included German nationals alongside volunteers and conscripts from both occupied and unoccupied lands. Over the course of the war, over 900,000 men passed through the ranks of the Waffen-SS. Two of that number were Irishmen, James Brady and Frank Stringer.
The irony behind the story of James Brady and Frank Stringer, the only two Irish people known to have served in the Waffen-SS, is that originally they volunteered for the British Army in 1938 when war with Germany was imminent. They're joining the Waffen-SS was entirely accidental.
That's historian Terry O'Reilly, author of the book Hitler's Irishmen.
This case came to my attention about 12 years ago. It was almost unknown up until about that time, 12 years ago. It was only then that certain files were released by the British National Archives and by the Irish Military Archives, and the story came to light.
Brady and Stringer were both members of the Royal Irish Fusiliers, who entered the British Army within days of each other in 1938. They were posted to Guernsey in the Channel Islands. They found themselves in prison after a bout of violent public drunkenness. The two remained stranded there when their regiment withdrew from the island.
They were taken into custody when the Germans invaded the Channel Islands in 1940. They were transferred to a special prisoner of war camp for Irish prisoners in Friesack in Germany. They were apparently recruited to the Abwehr, the German intelligence service. It seems the Stringer was quite willing to go along with the Germans by this stage, but it seems James Brady might have had ulterior motives and was acting on the orders of his British commanding officer.
Despite the horrific crimes carried out by Nazi Germany, it is not believed that either Frank Stringer or James Brady were involved in the committing of any war crimes.
The only crime they were charged with was acting against the British Army. They had both been serving with the British Army when they joined the Waffen-SS, so obviously they're going to be tried for that. But there's no evidence that the unit they were involved in the SS Special Forces. There's no evidence that they were actually wanted for war crimes. Their commanding officer, in fact, the famous Otto Skorzeny, was placed on trial in 1946 for war crimes and was acquitted on all charges.
After the war, both men were court-martialed by the British. They received prison sentences that were eventually commuted.
Both of them were captured by the British Army after the war. Frank Stringer was captured in 1945 and Brady more or less turned himself in 1946. Both were court-martialed and both were originally sentenced to 15 years in prison. But the British Army decided to show leniency and in the event both were released in 1950. We do know that Frank Stringer actually emigrated back to England again, and the British police kept an eye on him for a while and just lost interest. James Brady, as it turns out, after an investigation by Garda Special Branch during the war and by Irish military intelligence, that is G2, they established that James Brady joined under an alias. They did establish that he came from Roscommon, but other than that, they couldn't establish his real name. So he joined the British Army under a pseudonym. So presumably in 1950, he was still a young man then. He just took up his old identity and lived out his life in Ireland.
The case of James Brady is particularly shrouded in mystery, according to Terry.
And people who knew him suspected very strongly that he came from an advantaged background. He did mention a couple of times that his brother had actually attended a university in Germany, which meant he would have been quite well off. Stringer, we do know all about Stringer. We established his date of birth and his origins. He was actually, his father died at a very young age. He joined the British Merchant Navy when he was only 17 or 18, and afterwards he joined the British Army.
In the end, both men kept a deliberately low profile for the rest of their lives, and little is known about either of them after 1950.
Brady and Stringer are known to have returned to Ireland in 1950, and Stringer returned to Britain for a while, but other than that, they kept an incredibly low profile. They didn't talk to the local papers, they didn't talk to relatives, they didn't write any account of their experiences. Most Irish families would not welcome the knowledge that one of their own had served with the Waffen-SS, so they probably decided the less said, the better.
Mark McMenamin was reporting there. And once again, Terence O'Reilly's 2008 book is called Hitler's Irishman, and it tells the full story of those young Irishmen who served in the armed forces of Nazi Germany. Well, that's just about all we've got time for in this evening's programme. We'll end tonight, though, with some music. To mark the centenary this Friday, the RTE Concert Orchestra has recorded an orchestral suite, The Burning of Cork, by composer Paul Frost, with solos by Mia Cooper. So, to play us out, let's hear some of that piece. It'll be broadcast in full this Friday on the Lyric Concert just before 8 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. Details of all our items as well as podcasts are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. Our researcher is Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Radio 1.